From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Advice is a funny thing. Who you ask for it depends on what you need and how personal the question is. Sometimes, even in this age of confessional blogs and Facebook, you don't know who to ask. For you, for that moment, we have Dear Prudence, the online advice column at Slate where almost anything goes. You ask, Emily Yaffe answers as Prudence, Prudy. This hour on Point, Emily Yaffe of Slate's Dear Prudence is with us, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Emily Yaffe, Dear Prudence columnist at Slate. Emily, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm actually in Washington, D.C.
Great. Yes. Happy to have you. There's a lot we want to talk about, but let's go straight to cases just for a minute. Breastfeeding mother-in-law. This just came in a couple of weeks ago. What?
Yeah, I love breastfeeding letters. I get so many wacky breastfeeding letters, and then the lactivists come out. This one was a woman just given birth. The mother-in-law was coming over to help with the baby. The baby started crying in the middle of the night. The mother-in-law went to get the baby, and the mother thought, oh, you know, my mother-in-law will be bringing the baby in to me to feed it, and wasn't happening. She got up, and the mother-in-law's in the rocker with the baby on her breast.
Was the mother-in-law lactating?
Presumably shooting blanks. This poor child must have been a little confused. And the mother wrote to me. She was outraged, but her question was not, was this right or wrong, but should I call the police?
Should I call the police on my mother-in-law who's sort of using her nipple as a pacifier for her grandson in the middle of the night?
Right. Well, maybe she was worried about, you know, those plastics and pacifiers.
Right. BPH or whatever it is. Okay. Well, maybe. Or maybe she was reliving dreamy great times as a young mother, you know, back in the day and her own son there.
Okay. I think you can't put the grandson on your own breast. No. And I had a lot of readers write in and say, well, you know, this might be a cultural thing. The daughter who wrote the letter did not say, my mother-in-law just got off the boat from X where it's common.
Right.
So, you know, we're in America. Let's just say the mother-in-law probably knew that wasn't cool.
So what was your advice to her? I mean, she was also asking, as I read this, about whether she should cut her off, kick her out of the house, not see her again. You know, what did you advise?
Well, in cases of in-laws, I almost always say you should have the offspring of the in-law talk to the miscreant in-law. You know, so the mother should ask the son to say, Mom, this isn't cool. We got some serious boundaries here, and we're upset. You know, I love you, want you to be a grandmother, not a lactating grandmother, which you're not. So, I mean, calling the police, it would have been a great item on the police blotter. Obviously, it's not, a crime has not been committed. So my advice was to the mom to calm down, get her husband to talk to the grandmother, and set some rules.
How do you decide, you know, when things get kind of funky, and you have some pretty funky situations that you're asked about in your column, Emily, at Dear Prudence, how do you decide when you label something diverse human behavior, and when you label it, as you did in this case, bizarre?
Well, you know, in a column like this, there are two things. One, you have to go with your gut, and then you have to do a gut check also. So I'm constantly measuring my instinctive reaction. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I got a letter from a young woman who said she was having an affair with an older couple, and they were all in love.
Like,
and
a three-way illicit affair, at least.
Not illicit to them.
Not illicit, just a three-way.
Three-way, they were all in love, mm-hmm. And finally the young woman had decided to move in with the couple. But the couple's teenagers were really horrible to her, and so she thought the teenagers should go off to boarding school. I couldn't believe this whole thing. Actually, it's one of the letters that made me think, I very rarely think this, but I thought, oh, is this made up? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out I didn't know much about polyamory, which I admit.
Polyamory, and that is what?
Polyamory.
The multiple
yes.
loves in one big love.
Right.
Okay.
So my reaction was, A, you don't move in to the home of a couple with teenagers. They come first. The parents got to cool it till the kids go off to school. And that's quite tough. Probably heard from every polyamorist in the country who denounced me.
Was saying, back off, you don't get it. Make way for polyamory.
Right. And I have to say, a couple of years later, I got another letter, this from a middle-aged man, long divorced, grown kids, moved into a neighborhood, really hit it off with the younger couple next door. And now they were in love, and they were having a very happy threesome. The younger couple had a 7-year-old who called this man uncle. I mean, they didn't make the sexual relationship mm-hmm. explicit, but they were in and out of each other's homes. The older man's grown son lost his job and was asking if he and his wife and children could move into dad's basement. And dad's dilemma was, do I say what's going on or not?
Right.
And I found that I'd actually kind of changed my mind. And I, you know, I thought, okay, as long as the 7-year-old is not being exposed to the sexuality of it, he has an uncle he likes. And I didn't think the older father should have to break it off. But I said, you know, there's no way you're going to be sneaking back and forth and mm-hmm. keep this undercover. You got to say to your son, you're welcome. This is going to sound weird, but here's what my situation is.
I mean, back in the day when Dear Abby and Ann Landers were doing this, presumably this kind of situation just didn't come up. Or if it did, they deep-sixed it. They didn't put that stuff in their columns. But you do, and it left me, and there's lots of it, and there's so many different. I mean, Americans are now making all kinds of families and relationships, and some of them are clearly out of bounds by old-fashioned, let's say, honesty gauges or others. But others are in a kind of zone where there are not clear boundaries. And I found myself scratching my head and wondering where you, Emily Yaffe, turn as Dear Prudence, you know, for your constant or baseline or, you know, plumb bob. How do you decide what's okay and what's not?
It's just a kind of, I hope I bring some common sense, life experience. I have no expertise and no qualifications for this job, as people mm-hmm. constantly are reminding me, but I'm not doing therapy. I'm not a rabbi.
But you're pronouncing, you know, what's bizarre and what's not. What's not ethical or moral, and what's maybe unusual or new or different, but okay.
You know, Tom, I really do try to take things on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got some bottom-line things. The kids come first. Mm-hmm. I can't stand drunkenness, drunk driving.
Ever?
Being drunk as your pastime, okay. I think, is seriously problematic. Mm-hmm. So there are some, you know, I get a lot of letters from second wives who really don't like the kids from the first marriage, or I get letters from kids from the first marriage who, and I hate to say it, it's almost always the wife who's trying to push them out. I mean, that, as I say, kids come first. If you have children, you need to focus on them before you pursue your own interests. But then, you know, I really try to take it on a case-by-case basis. And I think that makes it most interesting because I don't always know what my response will be.
Wow. And the stuff that gets thrown at you. I mean, sometimes it's easier, I guess, if it's about honesty. You've got your secret vasectomy column where the young wife was trying to get pregnant and they just couldn't do it. And she finally goes to her mother-in-law and says, it's so hard. And the mother-in-law says, Harry reversed his vasectomy then? The husband didn't want kids, and he just hadn't told his wife that he'd had a vasectomy.
Can you believe that? Can you believe that?
I cannot. I guess humans are capable of anything.
Hollywood should read my column because there are some great plot twists in that. Can you imagine this poor woman is going through agony of infertility and her husband's been sniffed and didn't tell her? That's easy. Pack your bags, get out. But I am not an honesty fanatic. Often people write in, they've had one-night stand in the course of their marriage, and this thing, sometimes it's years ago, and it's eating them up, that this dishonesty at the heart of their marriage, and they want to confess. And I generally think that's a bad idea.
Because, life is complicated, don't blow the whole thing up over your indiscretion.
Because I have heard from people who've received the confession, and the person who's confessing then, oh, my God, this horrible weight of guilt is lifted off me. And then your spouse has to, wait a minute, I have to rethink everything what I understood
about us. And it happened
15
years ago, and who's really getting relief here? Emily Yaffe, please stand by. Dear Prudence is with us. What does she say to the secret vasectomy guy or the wife? I don't see how you can share another meal or your bed with this monstrous person. Get out now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Emily Yaffe, author of Slate's personal advice column, Dear Prudence. Of course, there's a lot of history with advice columns in this country and well beyond. I mean, we got some funny old tape here. Emily, listen with us a little bit. Pauline Phillips was the woman behind the Dear Abby advice column. Started running in 1956, continues to this day with her daughter Jeannie in charge. But letter writing was not limited, at least in fun, to people. Here's a 1964 episode of Mr. Ed. Yes, Mr. Ed, the talking horse, decides to try his hand or hoof at seeking advice, too.
You didn't really write to Dear Abby, did you?
I sure did. Dear Wilbur.
And sign my name?
I couldn't sign mine. Who's going to believe a horse can write a letter?
Well, now that it's done, you know, I'm glad.
Yeah?
Yes. You see, Dear Abby's a very sensible woman. I'm sure she'll advise you to stay at home where you belong.
Well, Wilbur, if she says I should move out, will you let me live at Sunnybrook Stables?
And if Dear Abby advises you to move out, I'll let you live at the Y.
Dear Abby, a cultural staple, even on Mr. Ed in 1964. In 1956, Esther Eppie Lederer, better known as Ann Landers, appeared on the game show What's My Line, during which panelists had to guess her profession. Maybe you'll do it if the show comes back, Emily. Here's the show's host, John Daly, describing one of the letters Mrs. Lederer, Ann Landers, had received.
Mrs. Lederer got a letter from a Mrs. G.K. who complained that her husband, a, quote, glob, end quote, often disagreed with her college-trained views. And Mrs. Lederer wrote back, "Stop throwing his lack of education in his teeth. There are plenty of educated fools around."
There you go. And here's Eppie Lederer talking with NPR, sharing some reasons that her letter writers would turn to her.
There's no embarrassment. I don't know them. They trust me. And I'm easy to get to. All it takes is the price of the postage stamp.
There's Ann Landers, Eppie Lederer. We've known Dear Abby. Now we know Dear Prudence. Emily Yaffe writes it. Kathleen is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Kathleen, you're on the air with Dear Prudence, with Prudence Emily Yaffe.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, in a way, defend Emily here. I think if people are giving her letters and asking her questions, they know she's not a professional counselor, and I think she can say whatever she wants in return. I don't think that if they really wanted a professional's advice, they'd give them a call. But they're reaching out to her, and she can share what she wants with them. Take the conversation off the air.
Thanks, Kathleen, and no question about it, Emily. They're free to come to you or not come to you, Prudence, Emily. And when they do, of course, it's you're there to respond. But it's funny, in an age of, you know, therapists all over the place and Facebook, you can ask your friends or online blogs. I mean, why do you think they still come to a columnist like you, Emily?
Well, in a way, it's partly because I'm not a therapist. You know, a therapist to draw you out, not be so judgmental. I'm going to make judgments. And lots of times people are writing to me. They want yes, no. Should I speak up? Not speak up. Stay, go. And some of my favorite letters are from people who are describing how awful other people are. And it's clear they're the problem. So I get to, you know, I get to say, hey, wait a minute. It's you, which, and that's really not something a therapist is going to do.
So you've got more latitude in the way you can respond?
Well, yes, and I think people come to the column because they want a sharp, decisive opinion. I mean, readers want to read something to react against, and the people who write to me surely have read the column and know I'm not going to coddle them, but they're stepping up and asking me to give my unvarnished response.
We've got people responding to your advice right now. Marcia in Harrisonburg, Virginia. You're on with Emily Yaffe. Prudence. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, Tom. I just want to suggest to the advice columnist that she add a little bit to her recommendation regarding the breastfeeding mother-in-law.
Yeah.
When she said having the son talk to the mother, and she said that that was one of her primary targets is to, mm-hmm. when there's an in-law problem, have the child of the parent,
mm-hmm.
that she add that the wife sit in on that conversation so that there's not another layer of potential miscommunication. The wife would not have to say anything, but then she could hear exactly what her husband says, and she could see the response and clarify anything that needed it.
What do you say, dear Prudence? Get everybody right in the room. Don't just lay it all off on the son to go talk to his mom, and don't play telephone.
I can see that in some cases that would work. I think sometimes, especially if it's really emotionally volatile, it is better to leave the in-law. You know, the in-law itself has this kind of fraught quality, like step child. So I think sometimes it's just best to everyone to stay calm, have a one-on-one, and then maybe a larger conversation.
Maybe a two-step thing where the son talks first. Maybe they all talk a little bit later.
But let's hope there's not too much talking about baby on grandma's breast.
Once and done, maybe. Here, Harvey in New York City, you're on the air with Prudence, Emily Yaffe. Hi, Harvey. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks.
Yeah.
My question is, if one discovers quite by accident that one's wife has had a very prolific text message interaction, say 5,000 text messages,
okay,
in secret with another guy, and which has involved a couple of hotel visits, also secret, what should one do?
Hotel visit. So this isn't about how many paper clips they need to order at work.
Right.
Emily?
Well, given the pain I can hear in your voice, I assume you're not talking about a friend. It sounds like you've stumbled upon the fact that your wife's having an affair, and however you've come upon it. I mean, sometimes people are driven to snoop. I don't believe in just generalized snooping. But I understand there are cases where you think something's going on. So you found this information. You're married to someone. I think you got to say, sit down. We need to talk. I found 5,000 texts and evidence you've been at a hotel with another man. What's going on? Unless you really don't want to know. But if you're in distress and it's not okay with you, as painful as this conversation is, got to have it.
Do you find that all the digital ways of communicating are complicating relationships? I mean, it just wasn't as easy to, you couldn't have 5,000 touches, even digital touches back in the day.
Well, I just read a wonderful thing about how Alfred Stieglitz, the photographer, and Georgia O'Keeffe got together, and he was married. I think she may have been in another relationship, and they wrote these passionate, sexy letters to each other. So people have always found a way. But yes, obviously, now you've got the evidence that, you know, you can be in touch with your paramour constantly. I mean, we've seen how many cases of these embarrassing text messages get released. There's some, I read an article, but some large percentage of divorces now bring in Facebook as evidence because people, you know, you're hooking up with that old high school love, and then there you are at the Motel 6 off the highway.
Yeah, and boom. Well, we hope not just as quick as that. Ray in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Harvey, good luck in New York. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Emily. I just wanted to ask Emily, you know, with all the calls you get, do you think the sexual mores of America have changed at all? It almost seems like, you know, the problems, the sexual problems that were in the past are still here. I mean, nothing has changed.
Why wouldn't we still have sexual problems? We're still human, aren't we, Ray?
Yes, we are. But I appreciate. I mean, Emily is so reasonable and straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But will things? I guess my question is: will things ever change?
Have they already, Emily? Do you think mores have changed in your lifetime? Here you are, what, child of 1955?
Oh, thanks, Tom.
Well, it's right there on your page.
Before I started doing this, I went back and read a wonderful book called A Bintel Brief, which is a collection of letters to the advice columnist at the Jewish Forward from the 19th century through the middle of the 20th century.
Okay.
Many of them were letters unique to the times. About half of them, as I was reading it, I realized it could run in my column. You know, runaway husbands, cheating wives, married to the wrong person. You know, human nature is not going to change. We have new technology to assist all this. I think maybe one thing that has changed, and I see it a lot in the column, and I've written about it and get a lot of pushback, is out-of-wedlock births. And I...
there's a lot more of that.
I mean, the numbers are phenomenal. In the 60s, it was about 5% of births. Now it's over 40%. I think with women under 30, it's over 50%. And this breakdown of the family, the lack of fathers in the home, I think have terrible consequences for society. So there's a, you know, kind of societal change. Individual human sexual behavior, I don't think so much.
But what we accept, what we're open to, I mean, you got earlier this year, the letter that you headlined Twincest, ultimately, and you're responding saying to the writer saying, I admit this is my first letter about homosexual incestuous twins. What was that about, Emily?
Oh, that made me so happy. This was a letter from a man in his late 30s, who is an identical twin. He and his brother fell in love as teenagers, felt this is the wrong thing to do. They went on to college on the opposite side of the country, said, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. And after they graduated from college, realized, look, we're in love. We are life partners since the womb, and we want to be together. And they have been
together.
As lovers,
not just
brothers.
As
lovers. Mm. And they had been together ever since. The question was not, is this right or wrong?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't want you opining on that. His brother wanted to tell the family. He did not. They lived in a state that allows gay marriage. And the parents and other family members were saying to both of them, when are you going to meet a nice guy and settle down?
And your advice?
Is that a great letter?
Well, it's unbelievable. Maybe nothing's unbelievable. I guess nothing is unbelievable.
Thank you, because
everything happens over time.
A lot of people said, oh, that's a fake letter. There are more than 300 million people in this country. I think it's perfectly reasonable. The two of them are identical twins who are in love. I said, look, there are some truths that don't need to be made explicit. And I I think it's just going to be so overwhelming and potentially destructive to confess all. But I said, I think you two should say, look, our situation seems unorthodox, but neither of us could imagine finding anyone else more compatible, and we're just happy together and leave it at that.
We are identical twins. We're together. We're happy. What else do you need to know?
I have to tell you the follow-up, Tom. So, yeah. You know, a little part of me, is this made up? Dan Savage, another advice columnist who I admire very much, who's gay and writes a lot about mm-hmm. gay issues, mm-hmm. was furious that these guys wrote to me and not to him.
Wow.
And he said, I think I met them. He said, when I was first coming out years ago, I met a couple gay twins. And he said, I think that's the guys. In addition, I got a letter from a young woman who is in love with and living with her twin sister. And she wrote to me and said, thank you so much for this letter. My sister and I thought we were the only people in the world.
Wow. It's a confusing time because on the one hand, sometimes you feel like anything goes. On the other hand, the twincest guys were asking you, could we go to prison? It's the whole range is out there.
Well, I did talk to a lawyer because, you know, there are incest laws. So I talked to a lawyer about if they went public, is this, you know, a potential, could they potentially be prosecuted? And he actually said, you know what, it would be worth a consultation with a lawyer for them just to clarify their legal situation.
Yeah, it is a patchwork. I've got some questions for you from online to exercise your advice powers. Your irritated friend writes to us a couple of minutes ago. Dear Prudence, how do I tell my friend not to dump her giant purse on my kitchen table where my son commonly eats? It irritates me to an unbelievable extent. Thank you, irritated but loving friend.
You know, I get a lot of these letters too. You get the my life is falling apart, and then Ann Landers, probably one of the most famous letters she had was, should the toilet paper roll on the outside or inside? So this seems pretty easy. Just say, you know, Marlene, would you mind putting your purse on the chair, or pick up the purse and say, I'm going to put it here. So you don't get crumbs on it. That doesn't seem like a hard one to me.
And yet people need advice. I mean, they come and they say, how do I do this? People get stuck. Here's another one. Dear Prudence, I don't appreciate friends who send an invitation to dinner through a text message, sometimes at the last minute. Call us old-fashioned, but my husband and I think this is rude. What's your take?
Every new technology always seems crazy and rude at the beginning. Since you mentioned my birth year, Tom.
Sorry.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember when
85, I think I said 85.
When answering machines came in, and I remember the reaction of my family was, answering machines? Just call back. If the person's not there, the phone will keep ringing. What is, who needs that? So first you think it's ridiculous. Then you think, okay, fine, I'll get one. Then you can't live without it.
Yeah, there we go.
So I don't think it's rude to text at the last minute, but just say, sorry, we're not free.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Emily Yaffe, author of Slate's personal advice column, Dear Prudence, Lexington, Kentucky. Jonathan, thanks for calling, Jonathan. You're on the air with Dear Prudence.
Hi, Tom. How is everyone?
Pretty well.
I had a question for her. I got involved with a relationship in December. I'd known the woman about three, 4 or 5 years. She was 33. She's from South Africa. At the time of my life, I was not really a decent human being, whether it be drinking or just hanging out with the wrong people. We really hit it off. 2 weeks were really great. My father passed away on January 3rd of this year. After that time, she kind of took me to her bosom as a nanny. We really had a great time. I was going to move in with her. Everything was good. the time, she had a friend that was 26, and she was 33. The 26-year-old was really immature. Basically, at the end of the day, everything was going good. One night, the 26-year-old propositioned me for oral sex. I turned it down. The next day, she brings it up to the 33-year-old. The next thing I know, she said, well, you probably should have done it. It probably would have been good for you.
So where's this going, Jonathan? Did it everything blow up, or are you still in it?
Everything blew up. I'm on the streets. She threw me out and everything. She knew the situation that I was in. It's very unfortunate.
What's your question out of all that? It sounds like quite a tossed salad. What's your question in there?
My question was, should I continue to pursue it? Because after the date of, you know, all my stuff getting thrown on the street, she still contacts me and I do not respond. But she still contacts me, and I feel like there's mutual feelings. So should I just give it up, or should I pursue?
Complicated, lovelorn, maybe too many people in the mix, and you're on the street. What do you say, Emily?
Give it up. This is a mess, and you know, everyone, you're in extreme distress. This has been a very brief relationship. You know, this is July. You kind of got together in December. You've been through too much emotional duress yourself, and at her hands, it's over.
Do people not? I mean, they come to you. I mean, Jonathan, I'm happy for your call, and yet you got to wonder sometimes, Emily. Are there not, you know, brothers or sisters or friends or parents or rabbis or, you know, the preacher, somebody to go to? Are people lost looking for advice?
I get, you know, I want the column to be entertaining. There are many serious, very serious letters in the column. But overall, I think people come to the column because it's a kind of bonbon-sized human drama. But in my inbox, I get so much pain. There are so many people in just desperate, complicated, awful situations, you know, letters that don't really lend themselves to the column and certainly are beyond my capacity to solve. But Tom, there are a lot of people who feel they don't have anyone to turn to, or every, you know, your sister, you got all sorts of history with your sister, whatever. They don't even know how to find a therapist, not sure they want to find a therapist. Mm-hmm. And there's something about sending a letter to an objective stranger who's not involved in your life, who'll give you a read that draws people.
Oh, and there you are. Brenda in Augusta, Georgia. Brenda, you're on the air with Emily Yaffe, Dear Prudence.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And I just wanted to say, it's kind of interesting to me. There are so many of these extramarital things so many of these problems are extramarital problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I, too, was born in 55. And I have always been of I don't mind premarital sex, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. But once you get married, you're committed. So what is this wrong with the saying, I'm sorry, this is not working out. We need to leave. We need to part. Let's get divorced and go away.
But should you get divorced if you fall off the straight and narrow one time, Brenda? Is that your formula?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you have the inclination to fall off the straight and narrow, maybe you probably that's a heads up that something's wrong.
Now that's interesting. Do you buy that, Emily?
Yes and no. I think it can be an indication of all sorts of things. Yes, it could be that there's something really wrong at the core of the marriage. It could be on one particular night you gave in to temptation. It could be that it's hard to just be faithful to one person for decades on end, but you actually love the person and don't want to end the marriage. I don't think a marriage has to end because of infidelity. I am not condoning infidelity, but I don't think in and of itself that's a marriage ender.
Here we've got a question for somebody who's not even in there yet, but and maybe doesn't want to go there, but they're asking you, this is from a would-be or not would-be bride. It says, "Dear Prudence, how do you say no to a marriage proposal without destroying the relationship? Only been dating for 1 year. Yikes." I guess sounds like a guy has popped the question here. She's doesn't want to do it or isn't ready, wants to say no, but doesn't want to lose the relationship. What do you say?
Well, that seems actually not that hard. I mean, it's not, oh, God, he's on a different page than I am from where this whole thing could go. She's just not ready right now. So I think, you know, you say, I love you. It sounds like she does love him. I'm totally moved by this. I'm not quite ready yet, but I'm glad this gives us an opportunity to talk about how we see our future, what kind of timeline we see, and here's mine, and I hope you can be patient with me.
And what if she doesn't think she's ever going to go down that path? But here's a friend she doesn't want to lose, and he's put his heart out there.
Well, if she does feel, look, this is comfortable for me now, I don't see myself with him in 10 years, this certainly isn't the guy I want to have children with, then you do owe it to the person who said, look, I'm ready to move to the next step, to say, no, this is not going to happen for us. And then those two people should break up. But it doesn't sound like she wants to break up. She just feels a year's not enough.
Some things
and that's fair enough, especially if you're young.
Yeah, some things are very current. Others like that, maybe kind of as old as Jane Austen, older than that. Julia, Southington, Connecticut. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for your guest is, my husband and I are raw food vegans, and we have a couple of weddings to go to this summer. And some advice we got from a friend was to bring our own dinners and give them to the caterers to serve when the other dinners come out.
Julie, let me ask you, you say you're a raw food vegans, you and your husband. Are you strict about it? It's like no joke, you don't veer off?
Yeah, that's what we 100% raw.
Okay.
Raw, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. You know, and occasionally we'll eat, like, steamed vegetables if we are in a situation like that.
So you want to pass a plastic bag full of veggies to the caterer and have them serve you at the wedding?
Yeah, basically. I mean, that's the general idea, yes.
Emily, is that cool?
I get a lot of letters about foods and food allergies and food limitations and stuff. I really think it's incumbent upon the people with those limitations to make it as easy as possible on the host. I think this is a case where you could say to the bride and groom, look, we've got these limitations. We can do it X number of ways. I want to make it as easy for you as the caterer as possible. We can bring our food if it wouldn't be a problem for them to plate it. We can eat the salad and then get some dinner later and don't count us in the head count of the food. How do I accommodate you with the least stress?
I'm thinking that people today would be pretty flexible about that. I mean, we know there's all kinds of diets out there now. It's not 1959 anymore. I don't think people would. Well, maybe they would freak out.
Well, but here's the problem, where people, I mean, this caller is trying to be polite and not say, oh, by the way, here are the fruits and nuts that you must serve to me.
Right.
A lot of people.
And I don't want your greasy prime rib.
Right. And here's the other thing. Very few Americans are going to suffer from missing a single meal. So, people get all, well, if I go on Thanksgiving, they're not accommodating me with a tofu turkey. For goodness sake, just eat the side dishes. You're not going to starve to death.
Right. Sometimes it's humorous. Sometimes it's serious. You got serious yourself recently. I think really responding to the Jerry Sandusky story of all the abuse of kids in that Penn State mess, and you came forward with some not questions but story of your own, life story of your own, about three times when you were a girl and you were not sexually abused on a par with the Sandusky boys, and you were very clear about that, but certainly molested and made that public. Tell us about it and why you came forward, Emily.
Right. I just wrote this piece for Slate called My Molesters, and it was about three distinct experiences I had growing up. Obviously, I've, you know, been very aware of the Catholic priest abuse scandals, but there was something about reading the testimony of these young men who had been so horribly abused and mistreated, in some cases raped, by Jerry Sandusky. Mm-hmm. Almost none of them told anyone. And, you know, the pain and the heartbreak of their stories. And it's not that I had repressed these memories. I just very rarely thought about it. But it brought me back to my own experience of that. I never said anything at the time about any of these three incidents. And I understood their mindset. So I just wrote a piece, you know, very briefly. Once a cousin tried to molest me, putting his hand between my legs. I was about eight. Another, and I was 15-year-old high school student, a friend's father gave me a ride home, stopped, and then grabbed my breasts and tried to kiss me. And then the last one, I was not a child. I was 18 or 19. My congressman was a priest, Father Robert Drynan. I was at some fundraising event for him. He offered to drive me to a subway stop, and he also grabbed me and tried to kiss me. So as I say, I didn't tell anyone at the time, and it was just kind of reflecting on being in that mindset and realizing, you know, and feeling if I speak up, that might be worse than what just happened.
On the other hand, as I read this column, and, you know, you could say, well, why is Emily sharing this, sharing it now? It's so long. But there's something akin here to what you do in your advice column. I mean, people share real dilemmas. They share real human experiences. And you put those three examples out there, and somebody's going to read them and not feel quite so alone in their human predicament or their awkward moment or their molested or abused moment.
Well, I got, you know, no surprise, overwhelming response from people who had been through very similar things, and you know, lots of them also had not spoken up and understood. Interestingly, I've heard from about six other women who were groped by Father Drynan also, and almost no one said anything. A couple were at Georgetown Law School, were students of his, and said something to one other professor, and, you know, was told, hey, he's a, you know, very prominent man, don't say anything.
I want to ask you about something very serious in the news right now. I mean, I don't know what advice we can take, but let's listen. This is President Obama speaking today. This was in Fort Myers, Florida, about the terrible shooting in Aurora, Colorado, at the Batman screening.
If there's anything to take away from this tragedy, it's the reminder that life is very fragile. Our time here is limited, and it is precious. And what matters at the end of the day is not the small things. It's not the trivial things, which so often consume us and our daily lives. Ultimately, it's how we choose to treat one another and how we love one another.
The terrible tragedy last night in Aurora, Colorado, 12 dead, 38 at the last count we heard in the shooting at the opening of the movie there. I mean, Emily, are there things that are beyond your scope in this professional role, or do you open up to human issues as big and bloody as this one?
You know, this really is outside the realm of my column, but, you know, it is just a reminder of the ability of human depravity to keep shocking and horrifying. I'm just heartbroken for these victims. It's unspeakable.
I mean, but there may be times when somebody on the other side of this dealing with their grief, they could write you. They could ask you what to make of it, what to do with it.
I do, you're absolutely right, get letters from people who've been through horrible traumas. Often what I hear from people who've lost a child, been through some other completely life-altering trauma, is that after the first few weeks of the, you know, everyone gathering around, people go back to their normal lives and kind of have this, okay, get over it, get on with it attitude. Of course, people have to get over and go on, but grief does not have a timetable, and I think people have to be a lot more generous and understanding about that.
Well, our hearts go out to those victims and their families today. Emily Alfie writes the Dear Prudence column for Slate. Emily, thanks for spending a little time with us today. Appreciate it.
Tom, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
She's not named after a Beatles song, but it comes to mind. We'll go out with it. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.